It's not a formal shed. It makes use of the contours, and there's a great ring of houses which include shops and cafes, which is colonnaded so that you can actually sit in when it's raining. And that slopes down to a great church, and then actually physically adjoining the church is the council chamber. And when the council chamber was put up at the end of the 14th century, the city fathers, and they were fathers, got an artist called Lorenzetti to paint murals on the four walls of the city chamber. And the first four pictures that I've got you are of those murals. And the four pictures are, first, the effects of good government, that's on two walls, and then the effects of bad government, that's on further two walls. And so the city fathers met to consider the business of the city surrounded by these pictures. And I just, if you can see the image, the first image is the effects of good government in the city. And what you've got in the city is business. So people riding in, riding out, going about their affairs, discussing, meeting, courting, and it's a vision of human life just being carried on in peace. It's a vision of shalom. But then what they asked Lorenzetti to do next, this is the second image, the effects of good government does not just stop in the city. It gets spills out to the countryside. And in the second image, the effects of good government in the countryside, you've got traders coming in with their donkeys laden with goods. You've got people tilling the fields. You've got people winnowing. You've got all the business of providing food for the city. So there the city fathers have got this. They've got shalom in the city, and shalom in the city depends on shalom in the countryside. And then if you go to the third image, you'll see that the plaster has been damaged quite a lot. But as a warning to themselves, the city fathers had the effects of bad government. And they depict murder, assassination going on in the city, and they depict people fleeing, running in terror from this, that, and the other. And that has knock-on effects in the countryside. So if you go outside, you see soldiers advancing down the hillsides. Nothing is being tilled. The crops are being left to rot. The whole picture is one of devastation. Now, this was not fantasy. This was reality in 14th century Italy, where the city-states were constantly at war with one another. Don't forget, Italy wasn't united. So the city fathers chose to do their business surrounded by these parables of what it was which made life possible and what it was which destroyed life. And what impresses me so much is that in the four murals, they didn't just focus on the city, but they understood that in each case, the effects of good government, the effects of bad government, there was an essential link between town and country. Now, in lots of writing on urbanism, certainly the writing on urbanism that I've looked at, that link between town and country is missing. In my country, in Britain, we're governed by people who think that food is either something you get in a supermarket or a meal in a posh restaurant. And they have no idea that it actually has to be grown somewhere, that it has to be produced. And they think that in the world of the total market, everything can be solved by import-export strategy. And that's the question that I want to reflect on today, because I want to say that we cannot think about the built environment, we cannot think about urban realities without thinking about the countryside, without thinking about the production of food. And I've got four theses, which are these. The first thesis, there is an ecological crisis. Second thesis, cities play a part in this. Third thesis, there's also an agricultural crisis. And fourth thesis, both cities and country play an essential part in the economy of redemption. So those are the four things that I've been looking at. And whereas in the first talk, I said that the essential question that we have to ask is, who are we? What is theological anthropology? How do we understand what it means to be human? And how is that reflected in the built environment? Today, the question I want to put, and what I think is the absolutely key question for this area is, who is God? Who is the God in whom we believe? So today I come strictly to the theological question, and I want to say to anticipate that I think that what we're up against in our northern or western culture, whichever term you want to use, is a form of idolatry. So I think that where we are is precisely where Bauman was in 1934, and that there. You know, which God do you serve? We're with Elijah on Mount Carmel, or we're with the Deuteronomists at the end of Deuteronomy. So that's basically what I'm going to be trying to do. So, first thesis, if you go on to the first image, Simon Sharma, one of the best of our exports to you. One of our very best historians.
Which image
will you answer? Gilgamesh. You'll see that there's an image of Gilgamesh. And Simon Sharma says, we've lived with the opposition of town and country since Gilgamesh, so since 2000 BC. And my first thesis, that's the next slide, there's an ecological crisis which has four main components, and just go down, population, loss of biodiversity, environmental degradation, and global warming. So if you go to the next slide, population. So, as you know, world population has doubled since 1961 to 6 billion. And there's the question of, if you go to the next slide, where on earth it will plateau. And the United Nations says they think it's going to plateau at 8 billion in 2050. If you look at the population explosion in India and China, that seems to me to be a really conservative estimate. Now, the first day I told you that Milton Keynes was built as a result of a complete mistake about population predictions. So maybe those of us who think that the UN have got it wrong are being overly pessimistic. But we don't know that world population is going to plateau at 8 billion. It could be 10 billion. It could be 12 billion. It could be more. World population has to be housed. It also has to be fed. So the World Watch Institute, and I'm taking my statistics from them, they point out that world population at the moment is growing by 80 million a year. That's the next slide. You should have a nice picture there. And that requires an extra 21 million tons, that's metric tons, of grain every year. Unfortunately, next slide, the amount of fertile land is finite. So a tenth of land worldwide is arable. Next slide. Very pretty. Okay, a quarter of land worldwide, next slide, is meadows and pasture. A third is forest and woodland. One third is urban areas, deserts and ice. And as world population is growing by this 80 million a year, so the amount of fertile land is actually shrinking. So 7 million hectares a year are lost to desertification, 7 million hectares are lost to land degradation. And this isn't something which we can simply rectify overnight by going down to garden centres and buying millions of bags of compost. It actually takes between 250 to 1200 years to make 1 inch of topsoil. And 25 billion tons of that, that's metric tons, are washed down rivers every year. Already, people like you and I, people who live in high-income countries, need 10 to 15 acres of fertile land to feed us. Already in 1990, only 4 acres of fertile land per person, per each one of the 6 billion, were left to feed people at that kind of level. Can we take food for granted? Now, one of the things that we're very aware of in Britain and Europe is the melting of the polar ice cap. This is happening much faster than was predicted. If too much ice at the poles melts, then the Gulf Stream could go into reverse, and Europe, you should have a nice picture of Lapland there, Europe would look like that. The thing about that is that, of course, you're used to thinking of yourselves as the grain basket of the world, but Europe also contains much of the world's most productive agricultural land. Suppose it becomes Lapland. If the Gulf Stream goes into reverse, then the equator will heat up. That means that the fertile land around the equator will also no longer produce food. This means that both Europe and the area around the equator won't be food producing. And what this means is, if you go on, you will have a picture of the four horsemen of the apocalypse as drawn by Dürer. And the deadliest of the four horsemen of the apocalypse will be famine. In 1348, two-thirds of the population of Europe was wiped out by bubonic plague. Two-thirds of the population of Europe died through bubonic plague. If we don't take global warming seriously, if the Gulf Stream goes into reverse, 1348 will look like paradise. The image I've got there is a statue in Dublin recalling the Irish famine of 1848-49, in which 1 million people starved to death. Those who were lucky came over here, but 1 million people simply starved to death. And we would be looking not at millions, but at billions. So that's the severity of the crisis which faces us. Already in many parts of the world, water use is nearing its natural limits. Humans need 5 litres of water a day to drink. They need 25 for washing. 10% of water is domestic, 65% of water is used for agriculture, 25% is used for industry. It takes 400,000 litres to make a car. 80% of disease in third world countries is waterborne. In the Maquiladora region around the border with Mexico, water is so contaminated that they give babies Coca-Cola to drink. 2 billion people, that's a third of the world's population, already live in water-stressed areas. And we have the danger not of oil wars, which I guess is what the Iraq thing's about, but of water wars. And in fact, some analysts would contend that the 1966 Six-Day War was actually about who controls the headwaters of the Jordan, so who controls water, and that's been absolutely crucial in Arab-Israeli relations. So that's the first thing, that's the thing which follows from population increase. Second, biodiversity has decreased. China's lost 9/10 of its wheat varieties in the last 30 years. The United States, these are World Watch Institute figures, has lost 95% of its cabbage varieties, 91% of field maize, 94% of pea variety, 81% of tomato varieties. 1,000 breeds have been lost in the past century, and 250,000 are currently threatened. Britain, we are now dependent on 2 breeds of pig. 130 species of plant becomes extinct every day. We know about the problems with the ozone layer. What we don't think about is the problem that poses to food stocks, because gaps in the ozone layer not only give us skin cancer, but they destroy the plankton, which is the basic level of food for our marine ecology. And so if the ozone layer, if there's too much UV radiation coming through, then fish stocks could crash, and that's another source of food which we've lost. So that's my first thesis. There is an ecological crisis. I guess most of you here share that view, but as you know, your country's not signed up to Kyoto, and there are very, very significant voices in this country which want to say that the ecological crisis is a lot of nonsense, and we don't have to take it seriously. I think that we do have to take it seriously. Second thesis, cities have a key role in the ecological crisis. So the architect Richard Rogers says, the world's environmental crisis is driven by our cities. So next slide. In the United Kingdom, construction accounts for 30% of carbon dioxide emissions. Now, just think about this. I don't know your country very well. The whole of the UK at the moment is a kind of building site. I said it was a theme park the other day, but the other thing is that it's a building site. Wherever you go, there are cranes, and they're building as if there's no tomorrow. Fine, that's great, but everything has implications. We do nothing which does not have effects on our whole ecology. And this kind of manic building all has effects on global warming. Construction industry worldwide uses 3 billion tons of raw material each year. More than half of the world's population now live in cities, and cities use up fossil fuels hundreds of thousands of times faster than they can accumulate. The ecological footprint of London is 50 million acres, 125 times its actual size. The OECD nations, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, these nations consume half the world's commercial energy, and 40% of that comes from heating, lighting, and air conditioning. Next slide, the Sears Tower in Chicago uses more energy in a day than an Indian city of 1 million. New York uses as much energy as the whole of Africa. And then you've got a picture of Singapore. The larger the city, the more dependent it is on external ecosystems. Now that's what Lorenzetti was, you know, already recognized in 1398 when he painted those frescoes in Siena. Transport is a huge factor in this. worldwide, motor cars generate 30% of CO2 emissions. Third thesis, okay, and this I don't spell out enough in the book on the built environment, and I know that some of you here are interested in this, and I'm interested to know your response. My third thesis, there's also an agricultural crisis. Between 1939 and 2000 in Britain, the number of farms fell from 500,000 to 158,000. 17,000 people left the industry just in the last year or so. France lost half its farmers between 1982 and 1999. Germany lost a quarter. The US has lost 4 million farms since the 1930s. Now, agriculture, and in particular peasant agriculture, is still one of the main employers in the world. 1.5 billion people still work on the land. Unfortunately, what's happened, and I've heard Eric and others talk about the impact of agribusiness, the bias over the past 50 years has been more and more and more towards giant farms displacing the small mixed farm. So in the European Union, 12% of the farms produce 60% of all agricultural output, 1% rear, 40% of the animals. In the UK, 10% of the farms produce 80% of the food. And then this statistic from the United States, between 1987 and 1997, US farmers received $123 billion for their products, but they spent $185 billion in fertilizers, the need for diesel for their tractors, and so on and so forth. So they've been running at a loss. And I had a tremendous shock. I mean, this won't be any surprise to you, but I was at a conference in this country 2 years ago in New York State, I couldn't believe my eyes looking at the small farms and how run down they were and how antiquated the machinery was. And we have, in Europe, we have a very, very distorted picture of the United States because we only read about Bush and Rumsfeld, and for most Europeans, what the US is, you know, Washington and Congress and the Senate and so on and so forth. And we read about the agricultural subsidies. So I asked my host then if I could meet some farmers. And they drove me out to some of these small farmers. And I said, you know, how much subsidy do you get? They said, we don't see a dime. In the decade up to 2002, food retail price index went up by 15%, but farm gate prices went down by nearly 10%. And in Britain, I don't know how it is here, milk is a lot cheaper than bottled water. The annual net farm incomes for UK cereal farmers fell from $77,000 in 1996 to $5,700 in 2001-2. And people are selling up in Britain. The agricultural industry is collapsing because people simply cannot make a living. People want to farm, but they can't afford to farm. They can't make a living by doing it. So farm incomes fell by 72% in the 5 years to 2000. And this is not just a northern phenomenon. In India, there's been a whole wave of farmer suicides. Thousands and thousands of farmers have been committing suicide because they're driven to the wall, because they can't survive. All the immense skills and knowledge of countless generations which are represented in them are just put on the scrapyard. So the Genesis 1 text, have dominion. And we all know Lim White's famous thesis that Christianity lies at the root of the ecological crisis because of its idea that we should have dominion over the over creation. Now, what I want to say is, and I think from what I've heard people say up to now, some of you at least would agree with me, what I want to say is there are practices of domination in farming. Modernist agriculture is place-less, relating to what we've been talking about over the past few years, couple of days. It's place-less. So it thinks that it can dispense with knowledge of local conditions. It thinks that technology can do the job. And a classical example of this happened in Andhra Pradesh in 2002, when the then state governor was persuaded, I put in inverted commas, by Monsanto, to allow Monsanto to come in and show Andhra Pradesh farmers how things ought to be done. Andhra had peasant farming, and so Monsanto flew in bulldozers, they flew in heavy machinery, they cleared several hundred acres, they leveled it, and they planted it with their magic seeds, and they said, watch what happens. The problem was that nobody had told Monsanto that Andhra has monsoons. So the monsoon rains came, and all the soil was just washed away, and the seeds produced nothing. And that was a tremendous shock and lesson to people in Andhra, and the governor lost his job. They've got a new governor now, and they're trying to go back to peasant agriculture, or a version of peasant agriculture. Modernist agriculture is placeless. It thinks that it can get by without detailed knowledge of place and local conditions. It's inflexible because it's technocratic, and it's monocultural. So poultry, that's the next slide. We had chicken last night. I don't know whether it was free-range chicken or not. Poultry are reared in sheds holding 50,000 birds. Each bird has an area the size of an A4 sheet of paper. In 1957, you needed 63 days to get a chicken for the table to get to 2 kg. Today you need 42 days. The industry wants to get it to 33. Now that is what I mean by a practice of domination. Next slide. A cattle feedlot with 20,000 cows produces as much sewage as a town of 320,000 people. Okay? Cattle feedlot with 20,000 cows produces as much sewage as a town of 320,000. In this country, there are cattle feedlots with 60,000 cattle. Cattle consume as much grain as 2 billion people, and that means that our meat consumption habits mean that when we're looking at feeding the world's population, we're not thinking about 6 billion, we're thinking about 8 billion. And as meat becomes more and more central part of the diet of more and more people, so the number of the amount of food that we have to grow to provide all this increases exponentially. So livestock consumes half the world's wheat, most of its maize, almost all of its sorghum. We've got the problem, you know about it, the cost of removing agrochemicals from water. In the UK, it's $210 million a year. Gulf of Mexico can't support marine life because of agricultural runoff. Modernist agriculture is totally dependent, cravenly dependent on oil. If the whole world adopted it, oil reserves, it's estimated, would be exhausted in 30 years. Well, what about GMOs? Are they the answer? Genetically modified organisms, square tomatoes, other genius devices. So they're very risky. No one knows what the effects may be in humans, because they put genes in our gut which are not native to us. They produce superweeds. That's already happened in Canada and in Europe. And they're a way for corporations to gain control. I don't know how whether you know the work of the Canadian Christian farmer, writer on corporations and agricultural affairs, Brewster Neame. He's a great man if you haven't met him or read his work. But let me... Neame, K-N-E-E-M, Brewster Neame. Brewster says this. If five or six corporations have control over every seed of all major commercial crops planted anywhere on Earth, this is totalitarian. Add to seeds control over the genetics of all major lines of commercial animals, and it'll be somewhat more totalitarian. Then engineer all the genetics, plant or animal, to be hybrids, sterile, or both, and the achievement will be without question totalitarian. It will amount to the occupation of the land, the earth itself, by foreign troops and their local mercenaries. Now, that comes in a book that Brewster's written about Cargill called Invisible Giant. So, GM crops are not, it seems to me, the answer. And indeed, the director of Novartis said 10 years ago, if anyone tells you that GM is going to feed the world, tell them that it's not. To feed the world takes financial and political will. It's not about production, but about distribution. And so there's a real political problem involved in all this. That's the next slide. Monsanto, the big corporations, are hand in glove with our politicians, with our governments, and they're about control. Fourth thesis. Town and country are both part of the economy of redemption, the means by which God makes and keeps human beings human. And that is appealing to a view of redemption which we find in Irenaeus of Lyon, the second century bishop. He's a great hero of mine because he moved from what today we call Turkey, nice climate and everything, to that miserable place in France, Lyon, where the Mistral makes life unbearable for 3 months of the year, and also learned to preach in Celtic. And we know that he preached in Celtic to his congregations. And this is how Irenaeus describes the redemptive process. Through obedience and discipline and training, human beings who are contingent and created, I don't know what Greek word that translates, by the way, I'm sorry, who are contingent and created, grow into the image and likeness of the eternal God. This process, the Father approves and commands, the Son carries out the Father's plan, the Spirit supports and hastens the process, while humankind gradually advances and mounts towards perfection, that is, they approach the eternal. So, for Irenaeus, redemption is process, and it's an educative process. Now, in that educative process, I want to say that both the town and the country play a vital role. Okay, so that's basically what I want to argue in this section. Next slide. Drawing on the work of the French historian Fernand Braudel, he says, cities are the accelerators of historical time, turning points, watersheds of human history. Next slide. All major bursts of growth are expressed by an urban explosion. We can't be anti-urban. When we're faced with the ecological crisis, it's not an option to say, let's all go back and live in caves. Okay? We can't all live in eco-villages or communes. We have to learn how to redeem the city, partly because the city in itself plays a key part in human redemption. So our very word civilization is about what cities do to us and for us. We can't underestimate the contribution that cities make to being human. And as we know in scripture, the cliche is that the story begins in a garden and ends in a city. But cities play an absolutely focal role in the redemptive process, thinking especially of Jerusalem. But, next slide, cities have to be fed and watered.